trying more exposure in communities of persons of color or refugees, and we really are trying to get more people who haven't been in the marketplace before.
So far in Wisconsin, about 62,000 people have signed up. The enrollment period to get plans on healthcare.gov ends December 15th. Shemay Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. NFL Thursday Night Football, the Saints lose to the Cowboys 13-10. NBA, the Bucks are off tonight. The Bulls play in Detroit. NHL, Blackhawks lose to Winnipeg 6-5. High school basketball, WGTD Sports Live on Facebook has doubleheader action tonight. Indian Trail hosts Tremper. The girls at 5:30. The boys are following that game. The game stream live on our WGTD Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/WGTDFM. The forecast from the National Weather Service, partly sunny and seasonal. Today's high 37. Tonight 30. Tomorrow's a little messy. Cloudy and windy with rain, possibly mixed with freezing rain Saturday morning. Tomorrow's high 43 with winds up to 25. Winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, sunny and 26 Racine, 25 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Every so often, a book crosses my path that really catches my attention in a really big way. And that is certainly the case with this particular book titled Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, An Invitation and Guide to Life's Most Important Conversation. It is the contention of the author of this book, Michael Hebb, that we do not talk about death as much as we should, or certainly not with the level of clarity and in a comfortable fashion in the way that it's probably healthy or helpful for us. And he has actually created a creative agency called Death Over Dinner and Convivium, which is meant to, in a sense, encourage people and help create spaces within which one can approach topics like death without the sense of dread that typically is the way we anticipate such conversations if we allow them to happen in our lives at all. It's a very intriguing book, very unconventionally structured, and it has given me a great deal to think about. And I'm very excited about this opportunity to speak with Michael Hebb, whose work has appeared in GQ, Food and Wine, and Seattle Magazine. Seattle is where he makes his home. And this book is published by Da Capo Lifelong Books. Michael Hebb, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think in my introduction, I mistakenly conflated two things. You are the founder of Death Over Dinner, and you are, I think, the founder of something else called Convivium. Can you just split those apart for us, please?
Sure, I'd happily. So Death Over Dinner started as a class at the University of Washington. It's a graduate school class. We were really thinking about how we wanted to scale a dinner conversation, you know, because dinners happen one by one. Everybody decides what they're going to talk about. they make their food and they get together and maybe they have an intentional conversation or they're good at it, or you talk about the weather or something. And we thought that it would be really powerful and poignant to craft a tool, almost like a board game, so people could have really profound dinner conversations all over the world. And we chose death as the first topic. And that quickly grew into an international platform and movement and has really had tremendous impact. I think there's been something about like 200,000 dinners now since we began. So we might be getting close to the 1 million people sitting down to talk about death threshold. Convivium is actually, now I'm taking the work with Convivium, which is just kind of more generally looking at how we eat together and how we gather as humans and how we could improve and deepen that. And I'm now a partner at Round Glass, and we're doing that on a global scale with a well-being focus. So those are those two things.
So describe to our listeners what such a gathering might look like, and in particular, how such a gathering might begin.
Yeah, so the model for death over dinner starts with the person that's having the gathering. We want to get to know a little bit about them. So the website does this quite well. It asks you a few, kind of foundational questions. Who might be coming to dinner and, why you want to have a dinner about end of life or death? And because it really varies. Somebody might want to have this conversation because they've just lost somebody, or they've lost somebody long ago and they never had a chance to really connect with their family or friends about their grief. Or maybe, heaven forbid, you found out that you have a terminal diagnosis or something chronic that you want to talk to your family about. There could be a lot of different reasons why somebody wants to have this conversation. It could be a young family that just wants to get prepared and thinks that these conversations are really important. So when we know why it is you want to have this conversation, then we're able to create, the website just kind of magically creates a script for your evening that really, captures the heart of why you were coming to the topic in the first place. And so the evening, people host their own. And just like with a board game or some other script, there's no guesswork. You're able to, you're able to just follow the guidelines that we've created. And what it is a series of questions. First, you acknowledge an ancestor, someone who's lost, and everybody does that, and that's a very powerful beginning. And then it's a series of questions that lead people into really profound discussion. And really, this work is not about death. It's really about life. These are conversations that tell us what our priorities are, what are the things we haven't been able to talk about that we want to talk about, and how we want to live, really.
The book opens with, in a sense, a description of such a gathering. And in this particular case, you've really described the room in some detail and described the menu and so on, and a little bit about the people gathered there. I want to ask you very specifically about a wonderful turn of phrase early on when you write, "A dinner party should feel like a healthy secret." A dinner party should feel like a healthy secret. Explain to our listeners what you mean by that.
It's a little bit of an oxymoron because it's not. We now know that secrets aren't all that healthy. but I wanted to evoke this sense of intimacy, that a dinner party, especially one where we're going to talk about something that is this important, wants to feel like you are gathering with your closest friends and revealing something that you don't tell everybody about. There's that kind of fellowship, but also I think that continues on to talk about how important the lighting is, right after that turn of phrase, and that, people don't dance on a well-lit dance floor. They also don't talk about what's most important to them if the lights are blaring and there's a lot of commotion. So set aside some important time, set the scene, light some candles, make something that you're comfortable making. If you're not comfortable in the kitchen, order some really good takeout. This is not about your culinary skills. It's about your ability to be present and to really connect with the loved ones in your life.
Hmm. A little later in the book, when you in a section titled "A Word on the Table," in which you kind of I think explore why for you it is your preference that these conversations occur around the dinner table. You write, "I am biased in favor of talking about death over dinner, as the dinner table is the most important crucible of culture we have as humans." I wonder if you would explain some of the ways in which you feel that that is true. And I think you're saying that is true in a lot of different ways, but it also is particularly applicable to what we are talking about with your book, Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner.
Yeah, and so for the listeners, my background is for the last 20 years, I've been gathering world leaders, politicians, Nobel Prize winners, artists, at the dinner table to talk about some of the most critical issues we face. And I've been all over the world doing it, and I've tried just about every conversational topic I could come up with or they could come up with. And so I've been the guy who would ask the very tough questions, is the powerful in some sense. And it's been an extraordinary experience, but I wanted to figure out how to share my experience with everyone, and that's where Death Over Dinner came from. But along the way, I really started to understand that the table does create and has created the culture that we have. In many ways, if you look back at where, since it was just voting day, if you look at where the idea of democracy came from, or our justice system, and especially with Ruth Bader Ginsburg just, flirting with a little bit of hospitalization, our justice system and the idea of democracy came from the symposiums in ancient Greece, the dinner tables that Plato, dinner parties that Plato and Socrates and Aristotle and the leaders of Athens would attend. And it isn't that these ideas just were shouted in the public square. An idea as big and as sweeping as democracy needs to be knit very carefully and over the dinner table in this case, night after night, really considering what society should and could look like. And that's, that's a very grand example, but the family table is where we come to know ourselves. It's where we learn who we are, our role in our family, our voice in our family. We learn about our parents. We learn about our family history. And so it has this very prosaic, everyday quality, but it also has this very grand quality where it has defined a lot of us, a lot of our culture. Mm. And we don't, it's kind of a secret history. We don't really talk about these smaller gatherings of influential or just common folk who have ended up, shaping the culture that we live in and the cultures of times past.
Hmm. I appreciate also, and this I think this touches a bit on what you were just saying, that in this same chapter where you spell much of this out, you also offer what you call a few words of advice, the first being keep it simple. I think you've already said that. It probably makes sense to not create a menu that's too grandiose and will create stress for you as the host. And you also encourage people to engage plenty of help from the guests in the preparation of the meal. You say nothing breaks the ice more than people working together, even if it's in as basic a task as setting a table. And I think that's such a good point and so easily missed, and that I should think for this kind of a gathering would be especially helpful.
Yeah, we're used to the idea, many of us, that when we host people, it's a kind of performance or everything is taken care of. Come to my house and all you have to do is, be charming, or arrive on time, bring a bottle of wine, or whatever it may be. And the thing is that the dinner table really functions best when everybody feels like they're invested, like they're participating. And so I like to get people to cook together, not just arrive waiting to be fed. I like to get them engaged in setting the table or going out into the yard and cutting flowers, if that's the season, or if you have a herb garden, making sure that someone goes out and cuts some sage or some rosemary. And just even these little things change how people engage. Like we talked about in the book, it's a very simple icebreaker. And the other thing is, the idea with the book is that this conversation can happen anywhere. It's not just tied to the table. You know, we've seen great success with getting people to sit down and have this conversation over the dinner table. I think it's a very comfortable place for some, but it's not for everybody. The book was written so that you would have these tools to open up the conversation, begin the conversation, whether you're on a hike or on the interstate or even over email, to start to warm up people to this this topic. And I realize it is a very difficult conversation for many, and I have a lot of compassion. It took me 5 years to bring my mother and brother to one of these dinners after doing this work myself. Huh.
Wow. I want to talk in a moment about the prompts that are a very significant part of this book, a number of prompts that could be potentially helpful in sort of not exactly steering the conversation, maybe literally prompting the conversation. But I want to make sure that I give you a chance to talk about the way in which you advise these evenings to begin with a very special kind of toast, a toast that I think could be really meaningful in and of itself. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and this is something that is done in many cultures. It has been throughout time, regardless of whether you're about to spend the whole evening talking about death or some other topic. The way that we begin every death dinner is by acknowledging somebody who's no longer with us, who's died, somebody who's had a powerful impact on our life. And, you know, it's like acknowledging our ancestors. And people often will light a candle. We suggest either lighting a candle or raising a glass, or sometimes both. And there's something very, very powerful that happens when you do this simple gesture. When you read about it or hear about it, it's like, oh, well, that might be interesting or nice. But the way that the table changes, just the feeling of the table and the connection of the people at it from this simple 5 minutes around the table gesture is really profound. You immediately feel like you're in a different time and place, and that you're surrounded by these people that, in some way, surrounded by the people that you've lost.
As for the prompts, I have to say, and I forgot to count them, how many prompts are there? There are more than I expected.
There are 26.
Ah, and it's a great list. And just to be clear, you don't advise at all that people try to explore all 26 of these prompts. I can't imagine how that would go. But I think you suggest that maybe three or four might be helpful. And of course, it's not that you should limit yourself to these particular prompts, but I do have to say that I really found this to be a very, very intriguing list. I wonder if you would share with our listeners maybe several of what you think are maybe several of the most intriguing prompts here and the way in which they might work in a typical gathering like this.
Yeah, you bet. And the prompts were the idea of including them in the book and making them the chapter heads. Was inspired a little bit by the New York Times article of a few years ago, 32 Questions to Fall in Love. And I don't know if you saw that, but it was one of the most emailed New York Times articles of that year. And just this idea that questions in and of themselves can make people fall in love or have them get closer to each other, which is actually the case. And so the prompts that we have in the book are ones that are time-tested at hundreds of dinners. And they range from the more easy, the more everyday, the questions that people may have heard before, to ones that are a little bit more in the deep end of the pool. So on the easier side, we have questions like, you know, what song would you like to have at your funeral? Or what would your last meal be? And people don't necessarily know they're talking about end of life when they're answering that question. You know, it's kind of, like I said, it's the putting the foot in the shallow end of the pool and just getting a little bit used to the water. And then they move into kind of, I'd say, more of that deep end pretty quickly if people are ready. And that's a question like, you've just found out you have 30 days left to live. How are you going to spend your time? How do you feel? What do you spend your last day like? Where are you? Who's around you during your last hour? And so they have this real poignancy to them. Or what happens to your body when you're gone? These are things we really want our loved ones to know. They're going to have to make decisions for us ultimately.
I found that some of the questions, some were very much expected, and then there were several that I did not necessarily expect. And I think of those, the one that intrigued me most was, how long should we grieve? In other words, I think what would the scenario would be that you are around a table with people you know well, maybe beloved family members or very, very close friends. And I think what is behind that question is, when one of you dies, how long would you want us to grieve? Can you talk about what was behind you crafting that prompt? And where would you hope a response to that prompt might take someone? Or in what way might that kind of a conversation be helpful?
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of a trick question. We like to ascribe very linear units of time in our culture, right? We know how long maternity and paternity leave should be. We think about what it feels like to be 40. We think about what we can get done in a minute. Tim Ferriss has the 4-hour work week. there's a lot of very finite units that we're comfortable with. The thing with grief is it's not finite. Everyone grieves differently. And some people never stop grieving a person that they've lost. And so the idea with that question is to get people to talk about their grief, to talk about what that experience has been like for them, because it is such a unique experience for everybody and we can learn. And because somebody in our life might still be grieving somebody actively, and we might not be aware of it. So it's a little bit just a leading question to get people to talk about grief in general and length of grief. And then also it's meant to create some compassion for, you know, just precisely how human we are.
What do you think is the significance of who exactly is gathered together for these conversations? And I guess maybe part of my question is, how careful does one have to be about who those people are, their particular personality types? Are there concerns that sort of need to be thought about when it comes time to actually, in a sense, do the convening, the inviting?
Well, the thing about hosting a death dinner or a conversation or starting a conversation about end of life is people self-select. So I don't think you have to be too concerned. If somebody's not ready to have this conversation, then they're not going to come. They're not going to RSVP. They're not going to say, they're not going to lean in, if you will, and continue to have the conversation if you're just having it on a walk or in the car. They'll let you know quite quickly where they stand. So it has that going for it. As far as who should be at the table, it's a little bit about what work do you want to do personally. Do you want to, you know, be really bold, like I wasn't able to be immediately, and invite your family and your closest friends to the table? And the reason to have them at a table hearing about your wishes is that you're either going to be advocating for them or honoring them when they're dead, making some decisions, or the reverse is true, and they're going to be in a position where it's on them to talk to doctors and nurses about your care plan and about your trajectory, you know, through the final chapter of your life, and make decisions about your memorial and what happens to your body. So we want our loved ones to know this, and we want to know this from our loved ones, even though it is something that we've made uncomfortable in our culture because we don't talk about it. The idea is to get back to fluency. We've become what I like to call death illiterate, and I think that with illiteracy, we lack empowered decisions or the ability to make empowered decisions. I'm not sure of any kind of literacy. But having friends or even coworkers, or sometimes people have strangers, that's a great way just to kind of, you know, get used to this conversation, to get to know yourself around a little bit better before you decide to turn your Thanksgiving into a dinner.
Right. I mean, I'm reminded of something you say in the book, that one of your golden rules about this is never surprise someone with a death dinner or even a conversation about death. Consent is key. And I also appreciate the fact that you share very honestly about how this was rather hard for you to do with your own mother and brother. So I think you say something about that you, I do not profess to be some kind of exemplary end-of-life citizen. I mean, this wasn't especially simple for you, and yet you are ultimately really glad that you did this. I'd like to finish by having you share with our listeners something you say towards the beginning of the book about how this book should be used. As I said in my introduction, this is a somewhat unconventional book in the way that it is laid out, and you say that someone might even find this book a little bit irritating if they pick it up with certain expectations. How would you have a reader use this book?
Yeah, well, I think as you note, that there are not bulleted answers about what happens to you when you die, where you go. It's not a manual. And what it is it's filled with more questions than it is answers. But it is filled with incredible stories from people that show that facing this topic does lead to more vitality. It does lead to a richer life. It does reduce the stress around this conversation, the fact that we eventually do pass. And so, you know, I hope that people sit down with it over a few weeks and read it, let it sink in, and then refer back to it when they're like, oh, I do want to talk to my father, and let me try this question and see if it hits. Because the other thing is people like to point fingers in their life and say, my father, my mother, my spouse, they don't want to have this conversation, or they're terrified of this topic. But in often cases, people haven't asked. And so it kind of begins with the effort of asking to see where somebody is at, really, and then trying again and again.
Sure. And I love this line towards the end of the book. Together, we have walked through many dark canyons in this book, places we don't often go, alone or even with friends. And I know I have said it before, but it is a simple truth that bears repeating. There are no easy answers as we head into this territory. There is a compass, however, and I think that compass is gratitude. The book, again, is Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation, published by Da Capo Lifelong Books, the author, Michael Hebb. Michael Hebb, I have very, very much enjoyed reading your book. It gave me much to think about, and I'm very, very grateful for you joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait to hear it, and we'll share it widely.
And the time is 8:40. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. And to finish out now, I'm going to play an excerpt from an interview from several years ago, roughly on the same topic, but approached differently, maybe a bit more seriously. The book called The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care by Dr. Angelo Valendez. The framework of the book, seven of Dr. Valendez's patients. And the book really focuses on the question of how to talk about end-of-life and some of the very specific decisions that one needs to make in terms of one's own wishes and also the feelings of one's loved ones. Again, the book is called The Conversation, published by Bloomsbury. Dr. Valendez, one of the things I really appreciate about this book is how woven through it are these real-life stories from actual patients that with whom you've cared. And I'll say parenthetically that often I don't think that format works particularly well if it's done carelessly. I think you've done just the opposite. You've treated their experiences with great sensitivity and written about them in such a way that it is genuinely helpful for us to be introduced to these people and to learn more about what they experienced. What sort of transaction was involved between you and the families of these seven patients who figure so prominently in the book in terms of telling their story? And did you change certain details or certain names in order to ensure their privacy? Tell us a little bit about how you handled that.
Absolutely. Privacy is of the utmost importance for a physician. You know, the patient-doctor relationship is sacrosanct. So I changed all the names. I changed certain details about patients and the time period in which I saw the patients. So I've been at various hospitals that are publicly available, so people can't go back and try to figure out who my patients are. So all identifying details have been changed to protect patients and their loved ones. Hmm.
I'm struck by the very first chapter called My Medical Odyssey, in which you... Oh, wait, no, that's the wrong one. I want to ask you about the woman who was Italian, who owned a restaurant.
And, yes, Nonna.
Yes, Assunta Antonia Bruna, known as Nonna by her family. She'd opened a restaurant in one of the suburbs of Boston, and the day she left tomato out of her famous pasta fagioli soup was the moment that her family realized that something was very wrong, and indeed what was wrong ultimately was Alzheimer's. It's fascinating to hear about this family, the dynamics at play, a very loving, close-knit family, but the way that played out ultimately, in a sense, did a disservice to their beloved matriarch as she approached the end of life. I wonder if, first of all, maybe you should fill in some of the gaps I've just left in my description. What kind of a family are we talking about, and how did they find themselves in a really uncomfortable situation in terms of making decisions about Assunta Antonia Bruna, or Nonna?
This is one of those families that all of us aspire to be: loving, caring, every Sunday together, every holiday, every event in the children's life, whether it was a baptism, a wedding, or a funeral, was celebrated together and with love. And so here you have a very large family, and the matriarch, Nonna, who had, I forgot how many grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and three children of her own. And yet no one throughout the course of their lives together, no one had actually started the discussion about what was important to her in terms of healthcare. And so in the earliest stages, when Alzheimer's began to appear for her, for her, she was a wonderful cook. And the ingredients, the way she used to make her pasta fagioli, she forgot one time to add the very special ingredient of tomatoes. And that's how the diagnosis was made for her. And yet, when I saw her for the first time, she was admitted to the hospital, and now she was in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease. And so I was stuck trying to figure out, trying to learn who this woman was, trying to learn where her family was in their journey with this illness, because although Alzheimer's affects the patient, the devastation that it produces is also on the family, because the family is left with this burden of trying to decide what is best for their mother, and yet no one had ever had a conversation with her about what Nona wanted in terms of a feeding tube, in terms of breathing machines, in terms of all these aggressive interventions we have in medicine. And so it's an event, unfortunately, that is replayed thousands of times a day in our hospital system today. There are so many patients with Alzheimer's disease. By the year 2050, there will be 15 million Americans with Alzheimer's dementia. That's an epidemic. The way we view and have viewed cancer in our culture for the last few decades, I feel the new cancer will be Alzheimer's disease. And so not only did it devastate Nona, but it devastated her family as they struggled to try to make decisions that they were comfortable with and that honored and respected Nona. Unfortunately, I took care of her over the course of a few weeks, and unfortunately for Nona, I believe we did numerous things that if she actually had this conversation with her daughter and with her other children, she never would have wanted. Unfortunately, I do feel that as providers, we tortured Nona, putting her in the ICU, putting her on breathing machine, even inserting a feeding tube, where if someone had a conversation with her about whether or not these procedures would actually have helped her, she probably would have declined all of them. Hmm. It's something that still haunts me, and I use that word intentionally, haunts me every time I meet a patient in the hospital that I'm taking care of with Alzheimer's disease. Hmm.
You make a couple of very intriguing points in this chapter. One of them is specifically about the matter of a feeding tube and the fact that in many cases, and it was certainly the case with this very close-knit Italian family, that there was something about the notion of nourishing a loved one that had always been really important to them, that the dinner table was a central gathering place for the family, and you could express your love for one another in no better way than by lavishing care on a wonderful meal. And so you give us the sense that for this family, the notion of either removing a feeding tube or not giving a feeding tube to this woman was in a sense contradictory to one of the most sort of sacred signs of love that had been part of this family. And I think a lot of us don't stop to think about that dynamic perhaps playing a role in why people just cannot bring themselves to make a clear and maybe more rational, objective decision about something like a feeding tube.
Absolutely. And I failed to recognize that emotional balance in that decision. You know, often in medicine, we ask families to make decisions, and we just look at the risks and benefits, right? You know, I give them the medical data. I tell them that, you know, in advanced Alzheimer's disease, feeding tubes actually don't help. But what we often fail to understand as doctors is so often these decisions have great emotional import, and there's nothing more fundamental, more loving and caring than for us to express our love than by feeding our loved ones. So even calling it a feeding tube predisposes someone to say, well, of course do it. Why wouldn't you do it? You know, the teaching moment for me was when I failed to offer the family another option to express their love to their mom, which was hand-feeding her, which was giving them, you know, I even do this today, is I say, you know, get that Ensure, freeze it, and, you know, you have an Ensure lollipop
that you can give to someone with advanced Alzheimer's disease that can let you express your love to your mother without having to insert the thing that we call a feeding tube that doesn't help patients. So often in medicine, as doctors, we fail to provide people all the available medical options. And that was the huge teaching moment and insight for me on Nona's, based on Nona's story. But unfortunately, there was a victim in all this, and the victim was Nona, because we did prolong the dying process. We did prolong pain and suffering for her, and that's something that I have to deal with personally. And part of the book for me was part confession, you know, as well, because all doctors have stories like this, where we often have to think carefully and reflect on some of the things that we have done, which often does prolong suffering for patients. Hmm.
In this chapter, you also are bringing up a very important point about proxies. When someone appoints someone else to be their proxy to make medical decisions. And this had occurred with this woman and one of her, I don't remember if it was one of her daughters, but somebody, Annunziata, I guess was her name. I guess it was a daughter, was appointed to be her proxy. But she was in the position of making these decisions on behalf of her beloved mother without knowing for sure what her mother would have wanted. You write, without guidance from the patient, proxies are burdened with uncertainty. Simply naming a healthcare proxy is not enough, because proxies are not always good at predicting their loved one's wishes for medical care. This is such a sad scenario where someone mistakenly feels like they've done enough simply by filling in a name in that blank on a questionnaire, but they've left out, in a sense, the most important step.
Exactly. This is the tragedy of modern healthcare, is we've been telling our patients, please designate someone as your healthcare proxy or healthcare surrogate. And yet we fail to tell them, oh, and by the way, make sure you have a conversation with them about what you would want. Because what we know and what many studies have shown is that proxies, your daughter, if you don't have the conversation with your daughter, they are no better than chance at choosing what you would have wanted. So if you're going to name someone, whether it's your son, your daughter, or a friend, as your proxy, you better be having that conversation with them. You know, I tell this often to my elderly patients, look, this is a gift you can give to your son and daughter. Tell them what's important to you. Tell them what sort of medical decisions you would make if you're not able to make these decisions on yourself, because you don't want to be a burden to your kids. You want to give them a gift, and the gift is telling them what's important to you.
Hmm. That a very important point is certainly made in the third chapter of the book, in which you talk about a Hispanic gentleman by the name of Miguel Sanchez, and one of the points made in this chapter, which I hadn't really even stopped to ponder, is how painful it is when perhaps a spouse realizes that their own spouse has not shared with them information that would be incredibly important for making good decisions in this moment, and that in a sense it can be on a very personal level very painful to realize that that your own husband or your own wife has not shared things with you that they shared with their doctor. Can you say a word about that?
Yeah, it's something that we see all too often. Here's a family, a couple that had been married for close to 50 years. They were high school sweethearts. They had gone all around the world. They had a daughter together. You know, they made decisions about financial decisions or about what's for dinner tonight. And yet when it came to medical care, no one had this discussion. They never talked about it. And so on a prior admission, when I had taken care of this patient, he had told me what was important to him and the sort of things he did or and did not want from healthcare, and yet he never shared that information, despite my pleas with him, with his wife. And so when the event occurred and he was no longer able to make decisions, his wife gave me that blank stare and said, well, we never talked about this. I have to talk to my daughter. And unfortunately, their daughter did not live close by. They did not have many conversations about these sort of things. And so the daughter did what a lot of kids do, which is please do everything. Hmm. And unfortunately, we did do everything, even though the patient, Mr. Sanchez, had told me he did not want these procedures done. But, you know, as a physician, I have to honor and respect what the family tells me because, you know, although I had had him as a patient in the past, the assumption is that the family knows the patient best.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a hospitalist, a doctor taking care of patients in the hospital, we often are strangers to our patients. And so we defer almost always to the family.
Right. This is one of the most fascinating points in the book, I think, is when you talk about this all too common phenomenon of a child who lives far away in another state, in a sense, dropping into this situation and more often than not making the pronouncement, do everything you can. And when you kind of mentioned this situation to a senior physician at the hospital where you worked, she said, oh, you mean the daughter from California syndrome. And evidently this is actually a term that often gets used to describe this situation. But you go on to describe how sometimes by its very nature, it will be the so-called daughter from California who will sort of enter the scene with, in a sense, an emotional agenda or emotional baggage all their own that probably has no place in the making of good decisions about the well-being of the patient in question.
Absolutely. This is a pretty common occurrence to the point where, you know, medicine came up with a syndrome for it. It usually occurs when you have a patient who has an advanced illness where everybody on the team agrees that focusing on quality of life and comfort, aggressive comfort, is the right thing to do by the patient. However, a child who hasn't seen mom, let's say, in a few years, who's missed a bunch of Thanksgivings and Christmases, and is the only next of kin, and we call that usually daughter who lives in California, says, no, I need you to do everything. I'm coming to see mom. And what happens is we do everything, and then the daughter says, please keep on doing everything. And it's her way of dealing with the guilt, the emotional baggage of not having been there for mom when mom needed her for years before this critical situation arose. Of note, in California, they call this the daughter from New York syndrome. But this is actually something that we see all too often in medicine, where children who have, for a variety of reasons, have lost touch with their loved one, and now in the final throes of an illness, they try to make amends, try to atone for their lack of attention to mom or dad, and insist that the healthcare team do everything.
Hmm. And, of course, you're making a very good point here. It, in a sense, underscores the importance of the primary point of your book, which is that conversations need to take place before you ever get to this point, so that at a critical moment when critically important decisions need to be made, they're not going to be made under the scenario that we're describing right here with the so-called daughter from California.
Correct. The worst time to have these conversations is when the patient is sick, when it's when you're in the emergency room, or when you're not feeling well. The ideal time is when you're feeling great.
Dr. Angelo Valandez, and his very thought-provoking book is called The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care, published by Bloomsbury. Monday on The Morning Show, the editor of a wonderful new book called Apollo to the Moon, a wonderful book that has just been released by the National Geographic Society and the Smithsonian. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com.
Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.